Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, Sugitana. Okay, so let's start with this. What's your name?
Q-tip.
Where are you going? Who are you going with?
Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. I gotta get it, I got to get it. I left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. I gotta get it, I got to get it.
Hey, welcome everyone to Drive Through HR, the number one internet daily radio show for the HR professionals. And today I'm not alone. We have William Tinkup available with us and a wonderful guest, and I can't wait to talk to her, Mary Ellen Slater. Hey, Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. Well, we are glad to have you here with us today. And so if you can kick off the show by letting our audience who you are, so for those people who don't know of you, we would really appreciate it.
Sure thing. So I'm Mary Ellen Slater. I am the founder and managing director of Reputation Capital, which is a content marketing agency based down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And we specialize in producing editorial style content for brands. And a great deal of our work is in the HR space, and where I actually, before starting this company, worked as a journalist for a very long time. So I've been writing about HR and thinking about HR and speaking about HR for the vast majority of my career at this point.
What's top of mind
Wonderful.
For you? Yeah, what's top of mind for you and your customers these days?
I'd say right now a lot of my clients, and also it's interesting because it's like both HR folks and clients are all kind of talking about conferences. Are they worth it? Like attending them, speaking at them, exhibiting at them. I've noticed companies that over the years have put a lot of effort into attending HR, like attending conferences as vendors are now pulling back. I've noticed other folks saying, well, we like this, we used to do this conference, but we're finding this place is better. And I just feel like fundamentally at its core, it's like people are looking for the places to go to connect and get the information, the knowledge, and make the relationships that they know that they need to thrive. And that's whether it's a vendor or an HR professional, you know, frankly, even as a journalist or a writer, like everybody in this space is trying to figure out like what is the best place to get those needs met. And I think it's in flux. I think it's a little bit in flux.
What's your general take on, I mean, you've gone to a bunch of SHRM annuals. What's your general take as you, because you've been as a journalist, you've been in a lot of different ways at SHRM annual. What's your general take of that conference?
Sure. I mean, I feel like there's SHRM annual, and I've been to HR tech, and I've been to conferences in every other, all kinds of other industries, like, so not even just HR. And I think my general take on SHRM right now is that it is still the best place to go for the HR generalist. If you're looking, like, it's so big, right? So the beauty of SHRM is that it's so big, and the pain of SHRM is that it's so big, right? It's like you could go in there and be completely alone and never speak to a person. There's so many people there, right? It can just be overwhelming. I think that the secret to getting the most out of there is to go there and find your tribe, essentially. Like, again, it's like so many things going on, so much information. You got to narrow it down and take advantage of some of the meetups and things like that they provide. Like, look for ways to use social media so you can be a great deal more targeted about who you meet up with while you're there. Otherwise, if you're an attendee, it just feels like a cattle call from, like, one mega session to the next mega session to the next mega session. I find it, even though you get your checkpoints for your certification, like, I feel like it's pretty hard to get good value out of that approach. And I would say the same is true for the vendors. Like, if all you plan on doing is going there and, like, standing there and waiting for that wave of people to come by and ask you for your free stuff, like, and you're just kind of parked at the booth, like, you're unlikely to really get maximum value out of that either. I mean, again, it's so many people. Like, you know which of those people are your customers. Like, you got to find ways to attract those specific people. And a lot of people are doing creative things for that. They're using content. They're using social media. You know, they're making the effort to set up the meetings, like, before they even get there. I mean, you know, if your approach to a conference, if you're a vendor, is still just, I got a big booth and I've got a juggler and I'm giving away a couple of free coach bags, like, you're probably screwed.
What's the I guess the best way, the funniest way, or whatever. How do you see people stand out these days? Like, what's some of the examples that you've seen that, you know what, even if it's not work that y'all did, even if it's just as you walk through a different conference, you're like, yeah, that's actually pretty good.
You know, I think that the people who do the best honestly don't even focus on, like, the flashiest thing. It's like, what I'm looking for are things that people do that really help make that connection between the people that are really their customers. And I'm going to give you, I know I didn't, you know, you asked me, like, other examples, but I can speak to something that we did last year with some of our partners. We partnered, and we threw a party at HR Tech. And I considered that party successful in part because we limited the size and the scope of it. And so that's something I've seen other vendors and other folks do. They do the same thing. So, like, rather than trying to have the event in which you want to attract 10,000 people or 1,000 people or whatever, like, narrow it down, right? Like, so we capped it at 150 people. I didn't want any more people in the room that I could personally go around and speak to. And my co-sponsors wanted the same kind of vibe. So, and it's not just, we weren't the only ones who did that. I saw other groups do that, too. Just more intimate, more connections, personal invitations, doing really cool things, you know, like when take advantage of the city that you're in. If there are special things that you couldn't do anywhere else, you know, invite your prospects and your customers to go have those experiences with you. Like that's, you may find that's a better investment than buying a booth.
Great. Well, talking about HR conferences, especially SHRM conferences, what we have seen is some people choose to go to state conferences, but some people not just to go to national SHRM conferences because it's so huge and overwhelming that is there. But what is your opinion when it comes to why should HR professionals go to national SHRM conferences?
I feel like there the possibility is there of meeting other like-minded people who specialize in what you do in other industries all over the place. You'll never find like the greater concentration, you know, of the people in your profession. I mean, there's great content. They get great speakers. You know, the vendors pull out all the stops. You know, the secret, though, is because there's so much you can get out of it, but it is like drinking a fire hose, right? So, like, I recommend that people do it. I think every serious HR professional should go to at least one, probably rotate through anytime it's in their region, like every 3 or 4 years. Go there, but go in with a plan. You know, if you literally, like, just walk in the door and, like, the first time you've ever looked at who's speaking and things like that, it's like when you got there, like, you're probably not going to get the most out of it. But if you sit down beforehand and read through the speaker, you know, bios and things like that, look for the topics that are really interesting to you, you've got an opportunity to do a couple of things. One, you can plan how to spend your time at the event really well. And then the other thing you can do is actually reach out to those people. I mean, I think sometimes people assume that the people that speak at conferences are like these lofty, distant sort of people, but actually if somebody is like doing stuff that you find really interesting and you really want to make sure that you meet them, like don't even wait to just like come and chase after them at the end of the presentation and be like, oh, I thought you were really great, and then all you've got is like those 3 minutes to try to talk to them. Instead, step back, go look them up online, like, you know, send them a message on LinkedIn or whatever your social media, you know, thing is of choice, because anybody that's speaking at a conference is probably active in social media. Send them a note and say, hey, I'm coming to see it. I'm really looking forward to your presentation. I'd love to talk to you about some of these issues. Like, you know, you got 15 minutes to grab a cup of coffee. And that will be a much more satisfying experience than just being part of the post-presentation rush.
Wonderful. Well, apart from this vendor hall experience and then this networking, the awesomeness of networking, people generally go to SHRM conferences mainly for the content, as you said, and for the certifications, those people who are already certified with HRCI and other certifications. So now that we know the fight between SHRM and HRCI, how does that is going to impact those HR professionals that are looking to get recertified going through this going for this SHRM conference? What do you think?
I think that right now there's still a lot of unknowns. I feel like even after the announcement and the call that SHRM had, you know, to sort of answer a lot of questions, I still feel like I don't know that I really fully understand how it's all going to shake out. And I feel like anybody who says they know is probably they're just guessing. I think there's going to be some confusion in the marketplace about this in the next few months. I think people will sort out you know, which certification, you know, the accent of Sherman has given people the possibility of, like, converting their other one over to theirs. All in all, I mean, in general, I was always surprised over the years that SHRM didn't have their own certification process. I mean, generally speaking, professional associations, as large and well organized as they are, would manage that for their profession. So this doesn't shock me. I think it's going to be – it's probably something that was inevitable. I think it's going to take a little while for it to shake out. But I think my one caution with that is that I feel like a lot of times in this debate about which type of certification you're getting – I think people might be, some HR folks might lose where I think maybe their focus should be, because I feel like those certifications are mostly backward-looking. They are focused on proving what you already know, like the preparation for those exams. I mean, it's all very much tied to stuff like if you've already been doing HR, like they expect you to have already been performing the job. It's like it's competency-based. It's a way to walk in and say, like, oh, I already know how to do all of this stuff. When what I would prefer to see in HR professionals is a forward-looking approach toward their educations. It's more like, what do you not know? Like, how do I go and acquire this information that I don't already know? And I feel like that is something that is often lacking, and that I feel like the overemphasis on these certifications reinforces for people. Go take a business class. Go think about, like, what is it that you need to know how to do and understand in order to help your organization or to help the organization you want to work with. And so just like more of that forward-looking approach instead of the backward approach of getting a certification. Does that make sense?
Yeah, wonderful. Well, in fact, I wanted to help out our audience, those who are the job seekers mainly. So by now we have read tons of content, like countless posts of this SHRM and HRCI battle which is going on. But still, the question in most of their mind is, should I get certified? Can this certification help me get a job? That is the number one question for a job seeker in front of us right now. So what do you think? Do you consider a candidate to be certified when you are trying to hire them?
I think that it's the sort of thing that I don't think it's a deal breaker for employers. I've yet to encounter, and I'm sure someone could come up with an anecdote that contradicts this, but I have personally yet to encounter someone looking to hire an HR professional that the deal breaker was whether or not they had one of these certifications. I think they can make you seem, in a competitive market, they could be a slight edge, but you, generally speaking, it's more of an icing on the cake. If you have a solid resume that demonstrates clear accomplishments in your HR role where you've contributed to the health and growth and productivity of an organization, that is what's going to get you an interview, and that's what's going to get you a job. Having the certification, I think, can feel satisfying, like, personally. I think, you know, it's one of those things where I don't think it has the level of gravitas that, say, a law degree or even an MBA or a CPA has, but, you know, I don't think it hurts you. So I think you probably want to think that employers probably don't care about this as much as people might think. They care about real demonstrated accomplishments, and a certificate can help back that up, but it's never going to be the thing that gets you a job.
Yeah, I absolutely concur. Let's do us a favor. Take us behind the veil in the organization. What's a typical day like at Rep Capital? Give us a tip. It's Wednesday. Why don't you replay
it? It's Wednesday. Oh, let's see. You want to tell me? So first of all, I'm not wearing shoes in the office today because it's raining cats and dogs, and my shoes got really wet. So step one. Step two, like, I did an interview with our new design intern, but in the middle of it, I had to stop and battle the printer. You know, that's the glamorous life of running a small, fast-growing agency, right? There are no people here to do any of my work. But overall, you know, we spend the majority of our time focused on delivering great work for our clients, like, as productively as we can. And what that's meant for us as an organization is that we were built to be centralized from the ground up. Even the folks that live locally here in Baton Rouge are not tethered to our office. We just moved into an office in downtown Baton Rouge, which we're super proud of and we adore, and we're setting it up as a collaborative space, you know, for us to do work together for clients and to have folks around. But at our core, I spend the majority of my time sort of interacting with our clients who are elsewhere, interacting with my colleagues who are elsewhere. And as I was actually just describing to the intern candidate, that you know, many days I feel less like the owner of an agency and more like the comrade leader of an anarchist collective.
And the type of work that y'all do, without disclosing names and confidentiality or whatever else, what's the type of work that y'all do for folks?
Sure. So I spent my majority of my career in traditional journalism, and what we focus on now as an agency is taking all that stuff that I and my colleagues, many of whom are also journalists by trade, we do that same storytelling, except now instead of doing it for a publisher backed by advertising, we do it directly for the brand. So we work for some of the biggest companies in our space. I mean, Monster.com it was one of our first clients, and they're still one of our biggest clients. We love working with them. So when you go read articles on their websites, you'll see that they were written by folks on our team. So articles, white papers, email newsletters. I mean, from my years at SmartBrief, I got really, really familiar with email and what makes for good emails that people will open and forward and share with their friends. So we do a lot of email, and we work with really big companies like Monster, and then we work with smaller companies. You know, we're just one person, and we support them in all of their marketing efforts. So it's really any given day, you know, it could be all kinds of stuff. It's mostly it's content designed to help generate leads and brand and build brand awareness.
And do you or does the market consider you a marketing agency, a PR agency, an ad agency,
interactive agency? Say the market. That's one of the beautiful things I think about what we've built here is that we are definitely in a unique space because the way that editorial content is our core product, but we also have a full-time creative director who handles the design part, which is a rapidly growing part of our business. I have someone also dedicated full-time to doing PR and social media and sort of more some of that traditional marketing activities. But, yeah, we do some media buying as well to support that. But, like, content is still at our core. If somebody came up to me and said, hey, we want to run an ad campaign and we want you to design, like, a billboard, like, I would send them to some of my other very competent, very qualified friends that do that type of advertising. You know, we don't do that sort of stuff. But what we will do is if somebody wants to run a campaign, a lead gen campaign, and we help them create the white paper, and we'll handle the design, and we'll handle the press releases, and we'll handle the pitches, and we'll do a media buy that supports that. So we'll, if it's content is our focus, like we are all about producing high-quality, tailored, custom content for folks.
Fast forward, 5 years, what's the agency look like?
It probably still looks at its core a lot like it looks now. Like, I don't see a straying from that core content factory model. I think as we've grown, we've acquired larger and larger clients. Like, we get some of the biggest brands in the country, you know, basically the Fortune 50, the Fortune 5, you know, those folks are some of our clients. So I see us growing and doing more content for more of those types of companies. Again, I don't see us turning into a traditional advertising agency. I see content always being at the core of this brand, and I want us to be the place that people call when they need content. Like, when they want the good stuff, anyway. I mean, you can always go use, like, Xeris or Scripted or one of those services to get something quick and dirty and pumped full of keywords, but if you want something that reads like the Wall Street Journal, like, you call us.
And I'm assuming because you're journalists, you're also pretty fast.
We're really fast. I think that's one of the funniest things about working with traditional marketing folks is they're used to that taking a long time to get stuff done. So, you know, they'll call and say, well, we need an article. Like, when can you get this done by? And we're like, tomorrow. And they just look at us like we're magic. Like, it's like, we all worked under newspaper deadlines. And you're like, wow, you're giving me till tomorrow? Thank you.
Wow. What's wrong with you?
In my life, like, I remember getting, like, as a reporter, you're getting assignments at, like, 4 o'clock. And it's like, when were they due? They were due at 4:30. You know, so this is a life of luxury to us.
Yeah, truth. What's it like to work with you? You know, give us the good and the bad and the ugly, if you don't mind. What's it like to be
hired? As I said, comrade leader of an anarchist collective. The other thing I'm really into transparency. So we practice open books here. Everybody, I think I surprised our intern candidate today when I was like, yep, even you. You can see the financials at any time. Everyone knows what everyone makes, including me. We're open about our pricing. It's published on the website. Like, I feel like – by being openness and transparency is one of our core values. Like we actually sat down and made a list of like our RepCap family values last year at our end of the year retreat, and transparency was a big part of that. I think that's probably also my roots as a journalist. Like I feel like let the information flow freely, and people will make good decisions. I would say the other thing about working here is that everybody hustles. There's a funny story. One day I was sitting with my daughter when I was buckling. I have a 7-year-old daughter, and I was buckling her into her car seat. And I was like, "Come on, girl, we gotta hustle," because we were running late for school. And she looked at me and she goes, "Mama, we always hustle." And I was like, "We are always hustling." And I think that is true too. Like everybody here hustles. You know, everybody here is expected to pitch in and do what needs to get done. You know, and sometimes that means, you know, when we get a big, everybody's a good writer, so I expect everybody to jump in. We get big projects, like, you know, even my office manager, I think a lot of you guys even know her, it's HR Gal Friday. She, you know, she's a great writer. She writes content. Like, there's nobody, all the rules at the company all apply to me as equally as everybody else, and we all work really hard, and nobody is too good to do anything.
Genius.
So, like I said, I was kicking the printer earlier in the middle of the thing, you know. And that's a core part of our ethos. Like, I blame my blue-collar background, but, like, there's nobody here that's too good to do any job that we have.
Wonderful. Well, talking about transparency, Mary, well, that is always tied to the corporate culture or organization culture of an organization. But is there such a thing called, you know, too much of transparency, or how much of transparency is too much, what do you think?
I think that we're transparent. I don't think there's ever too much transparency. I think that the question is like setting up a culture in which people know what to do with the transparency. I mean, for one, the question of like, I know a lot of companies still are kind of obsessed with not letting their employees talk about their salaries, and that people should know what other people make, and they think people will be, that it will create tensions and jealousies. And I think that speaks less about transparency and more about your core culture. What I have found is that by being transparent, it just takes all of that off the table. Like, there is no gossip channel about who earns what or what people are spending money on. Like, there is no, absolutely 100% no need to gossip about it, because anybody can walk up and see it at any time, or literally log in and see it, because we're fully cloud-based. So I think that it's less a matter of too much or not enough transparency and more about your own psychology about work and about your relationship with your employees and the trust dynamic that's there. You know, one of the things that I sometimes speak about remote workforces. I spoke at Louisiana Sherm about this earlier this year, and one of the questions that always comes up every time I talk about this is somebody will say, well, how do you know that they're working? Meaning, how do I know my offsite employees are working? And I always turn this around to them, and I'm like, I don't even have a slide for it. Like, I pull it up, and it's a person in the office playing Candy Crush on Facebook on their computer, or, you know, some variation that I change it around on what it is. But it's like, how do you know that they're working? The mere fact of somebody's butt being in a seat does not mean they're delivering value. And if that is your measure of someone's value, like, I can't help you. You know, transparency isn't going to save you if that's your mindset.
Yeah, I told you that the boat was going to crash. I told you. I mean, it was transparent.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about things that you've written. So in both cases, something that you're really proud of, and I know journalists, you know, aren't necessarily proud of things that they write, but let's just say that you're proud of something you write. You put it out in a marketplace, and no one cares. In fact, no one ever even looks at it. No one cares. And it's something you kind of write on a whim. You know, you're driving in, you're like, huh, that'd be an interesting take. You throw it out there, and all of a sudden it takes off, it goes viral, et cetera. In all of your HR, leadership, workplace writing, what's a couple of examples of those two types of things?
I mean, I think what happens with most people is that people don't think like their readers would want to think. Like, they overthink it and they try to get too serious. You know, I always like to quote Mike Clark on this, former Sonar 6 founder and now at Cornerstone. Like, it's like, anytime you have the a choice between being professional and being memorable, choose memorable. Like, choose to stand out. And I think that should be your guiding principle. And I think that what I've noticed in what some of folks have written over the years. It's like, it's the thing that they weren't stressing about. It was like the thing where they allowed themselves to be themselves when they were writing. That's when people are going to remember you and when it's going to catch on. And I mean, I was thinking this actually, since we're talking about Mike, even like Tonar 6 example, I don't know if he ever told you about this or ever shared this on the show, but their most successful email campaign ever was one where they made a mistake. It actually had a goof in the email, and then they had to spend all this time like sort of the way they responded to their mistake is what made the piece of content successful. So we spend so much time being so uptight and, like, trying not to make mistakes when, like, our mistakes make us lovable. Our mistakes make us interesting, like what we perceive as our mistake. So, you know, loosen up and write stuff that's, like, if it's interesting to you, it's probably interesting to other people, right? Write like you're telling stories to your friends. Like, people never believe me when I tell them that, like, HR conferences are the wildest conferences that I ever go to. All other industries, like, no one competes, not even stockbrokers with all of their hit like famous excesses. Like the HR people are crazy and they have the craziest stories, but we don't tell those stories. We don't talk about that stuff. We try to keep it so buttoned up, and you know, it's really, it sucks the life out of the profession.
Wonderful. Well, Mary, we have about 3 minutes left at this point. So what are some tips and techniques, maybe one or two, if you can tell our audience to succeed in their email campaign?
Oh, succeed in their email campaign?
Uh-huh.
Okay, sure. The main thing is, like, one, be consistent. The number one mistake that I see people make with email is that they are so hung up on making it perfect and not knowing that what people want to see is consistency and reliability. You have to decide. If you're going to run great email campaigns, you just need to decide that it's going to go out. I mean, what they used to say about Saturday Night Live, it's like the show does not go on because it is perfect. The show goes on because it's Saturday night at 11 o'clock. So you need to treat your emails the same way. Like, schedule it, stick to the schedule, and put out the best thing that you can put out at that time. Do not strive for perfection. Strive for consistency and liveliness. And you will find that that constraint will actually force you to be better.
Wonderful. So where can people connect with you and come and find you?
Sure. Well, I'm all over social media, so they can follow me on Twitter at ME Slater. We have a site at repcapitalmedia.com where we blog regularly about content marketing, including conferences and remote work and all of the stuff that I've been talking about today. And I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook as well. And I'm pretty active on social media, so don't be afraid to reach out. Don't be shy.
That's great. So I'm just going to use the last 1 minute that I have. What do you want to communicate to the people that are going to Shrimp Conference for the first time? How do they make the most of their Shrimp experience?
Sure. One, make a plan. Like I said, go through. Think about, make a list of the people you want to meet. Spend some time on Twitter. Think about who looks cool, and don't be shy. So come up with a plan. Don't be shy. Fire away messages to people. Jump in. Don't be scared. There is no, you might sometimes seem like everybody else knows everybody already. It's not true. It's all a bunch of dorks, and they'll all buy you drinks and just go and hang out and meet people. And don't be scared of anybody. There's nobody there that's cooler than you.
Alrighty. Well, thank you, Mary, and thank you, William, for joining with us today. And we had a wonderful time talking with you.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
All right. We'll talk to you all tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mariam.